There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon, as always. I'm so glad that you could join me here for some classic cardboard conversation. And we're not looking at necessarily classic cardboard, like in a vintage sense, in this podcast. Now, we're going to focus on a couple of sets that were new at the time, that were premium at the time, that were a little out of the box, too. Very creative, and one in particular, very original. But as time has gone on, they have kind of fallen into the dreaded junk wax bargain bin. And you know what that bargain bin looks like. Typically, it's an old, beat-up monster box or a Tupperware box. You see it at your local card shop. You see it at card shows. Has some kind of a sticker on it, like two for a dollar, three for a dollar. Or in some cases, it says free for kids. And the seller's not too particular if the person who takes those packs is actually under the age of 18. You might be 81, and they'll be happy to give you some of those junk wax packs. Just get them out of my establishment, please and thanks. But these two sets not only are original and unique and pretty sharp still all these years later, almost 30 years later, but they are affordable and fun and relatively easy to collect. And I am a big fan of the sets that are affordable, easy to collect, and at the very least, provide you with some form of entertainment on a rainy day. And I've made many of those purchases online or at card shows where am I going to get a huge return on investment with the purchase? Probably not. In fact, more than likely, no. But I look at the cards and I figure, you know, this is something that'll be fun to open up or assemble on my day off, or like I said, a rainy day, looking for something to do. Well, I can find that. And these two sets, again, often overlooked, forgotten about, do deserve a little bit of a second look, one more than the other, in my opinion. We're talking about 1991 Leaf Studio and 1992 Leaf. The Leaf brand, which was the parent company of the Donruss baseball cards since the late 1980s, mid to late 1980s, selling its premium cards under the Leaf brand in the early 1990s. And like I said, coming up with some pretty good sets. Of course, they still fall into the junk wax category where, even though they were supposedly limited edition, because they were produced in the early 1990s during the explosion of the hobby, there's still a ton of them out there. So the value of those individual cards or the sets, not very high. But as opposed to other junk wax era sets like 1990 Donruss or 91 Fleer or everyone's favorite redheaded stepchild 88 Donruss, these are, you know, not necessarily true bargain bin, dump them out of my establishment at all cost sets. You know, there's actually some certainly aesthetic value and some, you know, creativity. Good job, good effort to creativity going into these sets. So we're going to talk a little bit about those sets today. And I think it's a rather timely topic. It's also a convenient one. As I mentioned in our last show, my good friend Coach Mike McLaughlin picking up a few of these packs at a recent card show he was at, they were just kind of in a big box of random cards and packs and stuff. And he handed them off to me and I said, okay, thanks. And, you know, looking at the packs that were in there, I'm like, yeah, you know, I could do a show about this. But also rather timely, because have you been shopping on eBay recently for some cards? The junk wax market is getting a little too overpriced in terms of retail. Now, that's not for the smart sellers, the smart retailers who know why we call it junk wax, because, of course, there's still way too much supply out there and certainly not a lot of demand. But, and we discussed this several months ago when we were looking at a few, in fact, a whole box of, not just a few packs, but a whole box of 1992 Fleer. There is a lot of 90s nostalgia going on still. And because of the COVID pandemic, a lot of people have gone back into their childhood collections, or they have had their interest in collecting things from their childhood sparked because of all the free time they had, of all the time that they had to spend at home. It was a safe and easy escape from homeschooling kids, or, you know, wondering if you were going to have a job, or, you know, applying for unemployment, stuff like that. So one of the reasons why you have 90s nostalgia is just for a yearning to the quote unquote simpler days. You know, when you had a presidential election that was pretty much done on election day, for example. Well, Clinton rolled to a couple of those back in the 90s, so you know how that worked. But my point is that, and this is cyclical, and I've discussed this before, 90s nostalgia will very soon give way to early 2000s nostalgia. In fact, it may already be happening. I just haven't been paying attention. And, you know, in about 6 to 8 years from now, that'll roll into, you know, roughly 2010-ish nostalgia. So we can all relive the heady days of Lehman Brothers collapsing and the world economy teetering on edge. Boy, that'll be fun. I want the invite to that party. But, you know, it is cyclical and it goes through every generation. Typically, when a generation gets in its early 30s, and perhaps you're married, perhaps you've started a family, perhaps you've got a home mortgage, or you're paying off those student loans, or you just bought your own car for the first time, you know, not used, you're doing new and, you know, paying those very pricey installments for the next 5 years. When you start stacking all that up, you go, oh, crap. Why can't I just go back to like high school or junior high? And I would never wish junior high on anybody, especially myself. Those years sucked. But there is a general desire once you become an adult to want to dial it back every now and then, have a little throwback Thursday, pull up those old high school pictures or pull out those old baseball cards or comic books, or maybe watch a movie you haven't seen in many, many, many years. And, you know, you could do a lot of that and feel good about yourself for just a little bit. It's the comfort food of a hobby, really. It's just, you know, going back 15, 20 or so years and kind of reliving your youth. And like I said, that's not all that surprising. That's kind of what got me back into the hobby many years ago was, you know, hey, it's something from my childhood days. I had fun. Even though I left the hobby in disgust, you know, I had fun getting back into it. And certainly I have fun doing it now. Hell, I've done over 170 podcasts about it. So something's going right. But, you know, off the idea of 90s nostalgia, because of the COVID pandemic, because of people yearning for a quote unquote simpler stress-free time, you know, they're going back to the thrills of their childhood. And that includes a lot of junk wax era baseball cards. There are a lot of people who just want to start buying some late 80s and early 90s baseball cards, not because there's a lot of money in it, but just because it's fun to open up a bunch of packs or to try to hand collate a set. And I've discussed this before also. You have to be very careful as a buyer if you're getting into some of the sets that make up this 90s nostalgia, because you're starting to see a lot of articles written about baseball cards becoming popular again. You're starting to see a lot of, you know, videos and reports all about how, you know, resurgent the baseball card industry is, which if you're a collector, it's great. It's fun to have people talking about it and enjoying it. And the hobby could definitely use it, because, you know, the hobby got so saturated and collapsed in on itself in the mid-90s that a lot of people just kind of shrugged off baseball cards for many years. You could argue, you know, about, you know, 15, 20 years. And, you know, it's always good to have some good publicity about the sport and about the hobby. And as you're seeing these stories about Mike Trout rookie card PSA 10s selling for tens of thousands of dollars, if not more, you may be thinking, hey, is it time to cash in with my baseball cards again? Maybe. And I say maybe with a lot of hesitation in my voice, because if you happen to have a Mike Trout rookie card PSA 10, guess what? There is a very lucrative market out there for it. But as for the other 500 cards in that set, nah, the market's a little cooler on that. So, yes, there are some cards where after getting graded can fetch a hefty price, if you're lucky. But generally speaking, baseball cards, old and new, are still relatively affordable, but also are not something that you can get a whole lot of money off of. And, you know, I've offered this advice before. If you want to just make money, well, go play the stock market. You know, that's your high risk, high reward, you know, money farm there. But trying to nail down that one big rookie card in your collection and hoping on a wing and a prayer that it gets a high grade and you can sell it for a few thousand dollars. Yes, you could find some success that way, but often that's not how it works. And especially with junk wax era baseball cards, there is simply still way too much supply to meet the economic demand of a high dollar card. Now, there are some exceptions. If you have a Ken Griffey Jr. 89 Upper Deck card number one in PSA 10 mint condition, well, sure, you can get a pretty good price for it. But you also know that you can buy factory sealed complete sets of 1989 Upper Deck for a lot less money than you would have paid for them in, 1991, 1992. Same thing goes for other big-name rookie cards. Pedro Martinez. Let's see, who else? Manny Ramirez. John Smoltz. Tom Glavine. Think of all the big names. Griffey again. Even big stars from the 80s. I've seen some sales on eBay. You know, somebody offering up in, not PSA 10, but let's call it near mint condition. You can buy three Cal Ripken Jr. 82 Tops base set rookie cards for $50 plus shipping and handling. Now, back in the day, one of those cards in that condition was valued at $50. So even some of the biggest stars and in sets that are a little harder to collect, certainly 82 Tops vis-a-vis 92 Tops, you can still find some pretty good bargains out there if you know where to look. And I bring this up because as I was on eBay recently, shopping around for some products that we can discuss on this program, I'll get to that in a moment. I remember seeing a box of 89 Fleer, and the seller was selling it for, I believe, $40. And I did a double take. And as I scrolled down, there were a few more 89 Fleer lots. Two or three rack packs, $20. 4 cello packs, $20. 4 wax packs, $9.99. And I went, okay. Either I've got a gold mine of old Fleer packs in my closet here, or what is more likely is somebody sees that baseball cards are trending again and they're trying to sell these junk wax era cards at a premium. And of course, you lead off with, hey, you can get the Billy Ripken card here. Ken Griffey Jr. rookie, Randy Johnson rookie. Which variation is it? And again, you know, kind of like the Griffey Upper Deck rookie or the Trout rookie. Yeah, if you pull one and you grade it and it comes back as a 10, yeah, you can sell it for a pretty handsome price. But especially with 89 Fleer, all right, you've got Griffey, you've got Johnson, maybe you're lucky you get the right variation of the Billy Ripken card. As for the other 657 cards in that set, yeah. So, buyer beware. I do like sharing these public service messages. The only people who are really going to cash in on 90s nostalgia junk wax baseball cards are the sellers. Plain and simple. Because even if a high-graded, big-name rookie card is purchased by you for, let's say, $100. Honestly now, in a world where there are still millions of each card from each set floating around the world right now, there are warehouses in every state chock full of 89 Fleer boxes that were hoarded by dealers over 30 years ago. Is that $100 investment going to pay off even more in, say, 5 years? Probably not. And the only people, again, who are going to make money off of it now are the people who are selling it to the people who will pay that price. And I remarked this on that 92 Fleer show. I said, I bought this box for $15 at a card show. And 3-4 months later, I was at that same card show, same dealer, had the same box of cards, and he marked it up to 20. Now, is there any single card in that 92 Fleer box that is suddenly worth 33% more now than it was 3-4 months ago? Not really. All right, maybe a Frank Thomas card, maybe the Griffey, maybe some of those Roger Clemens black gold cards, but why should the box go up 33% in value when probably none of these cards will? So be careful if you're scrolling through eBay or you're at a card show or card shop and you see somebody selling a box of 89 Fleer for $40, because generally speaking, even if you pulled 5 Griffey rookie cards out of there, you're not going to get $40 for all 5 of them. And if you send them off to get graded, you're going to spend $40 each to get them graded. And there's no guarantee that you're going to get a high enough grade to, you know, recoup some of that money there. Or that there's a market out there clamoring for 89 Fleer Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards. So buyer beware. Just wanted to share that with you. It was a little bit of an eye opener for me. And what you just need to do is shop around. I promise you, you will find plenty of people. If you're in the market for 89 Fleer, you'll find plenty of people who will send you a box, shipping included, for $20, which is, with shipping included, not a bad deal. You will find plenty of people, if you go to a card show, who will gladly unload those 89 Fleer wax boxes on you for $10 a piece, just to get them out of their storage unit. So keep an eye on that. But if you are bargain shopping, if you are looking for a neat set with lots of stars and some pretty cool inserts that is affordable, easy to find, easy to collect, then you may be interested in the two sets that we were talking today, 91 Leaf Studio and the 92 Leaf set. And we'll get to that in a moment. First, some housekeeping. We bring Wax Ecstatic to you every other Friday here via Audio Boom and the RSS feed that gets picked up by Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, Spotify. We're everywhere, baby. Also on Amazon, too, now. So just look for Wax Ecstatic or ask your smart speaker for it. Yes, you can listen to my dulcet tones emanating from that gray, lumpy speaker in your living room, if you prefer. Our next program will be coming 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, November the 20th. And, you know, it's funny, since that is leading into Thanksgiving weekend. Thanksgiving weekend will actually be the following week. I could do a show about turkeys. And, you know, I do have some 90 Donruss and some interesting bad cards from the early 1990s. You know, I think I'll do that. I was going to do something of true value, but I just made up my programming decision right on the air. How about them apples? So we're going to open up some turkey packs. No, not turkey red. We're going to open up some truly terrible packs of cards. I've got a couple of 1990 Donruss. I think I'll open the 89 Bowman Rack Pack that I've been threatening to open for years. And I also have, I still have this. You may recall we did a show a little over a year ago featuring the packs pulled from one of those random pack grab bags that you can get online. And some of those are pretty good. Others, not so much. So I ordered one and, you know, got a few interesting sports packs, but also got some not so interesting non-sports packs, including the Desert Storm cards. Remember those? Yeah, we opened that up. But there was also a Music Stars of Today pack. And I believe it was from 1991. And this would go back to my middle school days. And one of the reasons why middle school was so terrible was the music was so terrible. And I'm curious if we'll find something equally terrible and terrifying in those cards. So there you go. We will have a Thanksgiving turkey show Friday, November the 20th. We'll look through some real turkey cards. And definitely 90 Donruss, definitely the Music Stars, probably the 89 Bowman Rack Pack, even though I liked 89 Bowman. And maybe I'll come across something else later. I don't know. That's enough turkey. I don't want to overstuff you on the turkey. But we'll have a fun little program going into Thanksgiving weekend. So if you are traveling, not many people are this year, but if you are traveling, at least you'll have some kind of interesting entertainment for you. At least we hope so. Now, as for shows after that, we will do a show on 63 Fleer. Had a listener send me a bunch of cards, Mark Skoback. In fact, he's sent me a lot of card lots over the last few months, cardboard donations. And Mark's been upgrading his personal collection. And he'll send me the beat up, and I do mean beat up. We're talking bike spokes would be kind to some of these cards. But a lot of cards from the late 1950s and into the early 70s. And I enjoy just getting them just to look at them. And I share them with my son. So that's a lot of fun. And in a recent shipment, he sent me some 63 Fleer cards. And I do have two or three other 63 Fleers in my collection. The 63 Fleer set we've briefly discussed a couple of times. Normally, when we're talking about either 63 Tops or 1980 Tops, because Fleer was a persistent thorn in the side of Tops in the early 60s, actually even in the late 50s with the Ted Williams set. And they put out a valiant effort to provide some kind of competition to Tops in 1963, but were squashed by the courts. And then, of course, for many years in the 70s, Fleer battling Tops to finally officially get into the market in 1981. So we've had a little offshore or offshot conversations, I should say, about 63 Fleer over the last couple of years. So we'll dive in a little deeper about that set. It is a pretty neat set. And like I said, I do have a handful of cards, so we'll have some fun with that. And we're also shopping around, like I said, for some cards. Recently, I've been looking at some 92 and 94 Donruss. 92 Donruss was a pretty decent set. I may actually see if I can find some lots that have 92, 93, and 94. Some pretty good cards that got overlooked by the premium sets, but also they just got overwhelmed by some of the companies and some of the sets that had a little more money put behind them in promotion. Of course, Upper Deck, Tops, and then, you know, their premium sets, Stadium Club, and all the others. And it's very easy to overlook some of the Donruss sets from the early 1990s. So at some point, we'll do that. And we'll see what else we find along the way. Now, if you would like to make a cardboard donation, in fact, I've got some coming from one of our listeners, some of the Burger King cards from the early 1980s, Topps Burger King. We'll dive into those in a future show as well. But if you want to make a cardboard donation, whether it is for the show or for my own personal collection, and I've had a few of those recently, Bart Hardiman, thank you very much for your cards that you've sent me in the past few weeks. Joe Begnaud as well, you know, digging around looking for some of my 1970s Topps cards as I try to complete sets. You can certainly make a contribution via cardboard donations. You can just email me at mattsammonsez, that's mattsammonsez at gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking, and I will let you know if I can help you out unloading some cards or, you know, paying some shipping or whatever the case is. That's always fun to do a little trade like that. Or if you would like to make a cash donation, those are also appreciated at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. And if you make a cash donation, it can be as little as $5 or $10 for a show. Or if you have a little extra money, $20 or $30, all donations are greatly appreciated. The cash is used in one of two ways, always back at the show. One, just the operations of the show, keeping our site available at audioboom.com, keeping the feed going, keeping the archives free. We like to do that. We don't want to charge you extra to listen to the old shows. So we do that with any donations. Also, we purchase the products that we discuss on this show. And if there are any products where we have just a little too much of, then what we like to do is donate those to charity, Commons for Kids, who help donate cards to kids in need. So your money goes a long way, and your cardboard donations go a long way as well. So if you would like to contribute to the show in either of those ways, you are more than welcome to. Just again, cash donation, paypal.me/waxecstatic, or a cardboard donation, mattsammonsez@gmail.com. Look forward to connecting with you on that. Also, we'd like to connect with you on Twitter. Again, our Twitter feed is at Wax and Gum Stains. A lot of people sharing some card collecting fun with their kids or some finds that they have picked up at the local card shop or card show. Brian Krause recently sending a fun picture my way here from 56 Tops. We've got a Billy Pierce card here. This is just a great shot here. The Billy Pierce 56 Tops card is of Pierce, who was a pitcher, at bat. And I'm assuming it's a bunt, or maybe it's just a really weak grounder. It does appear to be at Old Comiskey Park. And Comiskey Park, the grounds crew, was legendary for flooding, quite literally, the dirt and grass area in front of home plate And that's what propelled the go-go White Sox of the late 1950s. Your Minnie Mignosos, your Nellie Fox, the guys that, you know, this was small ball, you know, to a T in the 1950s, especially playing in the rather cavernous Comiskey Park. This was a team that went station to station. And if you had, you know, Luis Aparicio laying down a bunt and it got slowed down by the muck in the dirt in the grassy area in front of home plate, the speedy Aparicio could get to first base more times than not. So I don't know if this was by design or if it was just a really weak hit. But we see in the background the action shot, which you saw in 56 Topps cards, of Billy Pierce trying to leg out a ball that's rolled maybe about 6 feet in front of home plate as the catcher is trying to scoop it up. So, hey, maybe he's just moving the runner up a base. But I did mention that for Billy Pierce, who we've talked about on this program, he was one of our random card selections in a show from another early 1950s set. I forget which one. And he was one of the most dominant pitchers of the American League, an annual thorn in the side of the Yankees for many, many years. And one of the most dominant left-handers in the American League throughout the 1950s. To be relegated to the slow roller action shot. Not quite Rudy Mioli, 75 Topps spring training pop-up. But, they probably could have selected a better photo. And we actually discussed some similar photos in our most recent video, which, if you didn't see the link, is up on YouTube. Wax Ecstatic, 1991 Leaf Studio and 1992 Leaf Pack Break. I managed to get not one, not two, but three Julio Franco cards in the two 92 Leaf packs that I opened. So a little bit of a sorting error by Leaf back then, but it is showing a clearly frustrated Franco after a bad at-bat. And again, and I even mentioned this in the video, not quite Rudy Mioli 75 Topps, but definitely not a highlight baseball card for the venerable Julio Franco. So thank you for sharing that with me, Brian. And again, Wax of Gubstains is available 24/7. So share your favorite cards, stories about your favorite players, your favorite sets. Talk about the show, you know, any particular sets or cards or players that we discuss. We always appreciate your commentary. All right, let's take a look at the two sets that we're talking about this week, and very brief looks, because chances are you're well aware of both of these sets, and I really have more of just a pitch as to why you should probably part with that $20 that's burning a hole in your pocket to try to grab maybe a box of these and put together a set. They are rather small. They are wafer thin, as John Cleese would say. And let's start with 1991 Studio. Now, again, Leaf was the parent company of Donruss starting in the mid-1980s. And for many years, Leaf was the redheaded stepchild Canadian sister of the Donruss brand. So while Donruss was improving and growing in the mid-1980s, the Donruss cards needed to be sold in Canada. Well, much like Topps would use the offshoot, you know, the other branch of the company, OPG, in Canada. And of course, the Canadian cards had to be bilingual, so you had English and French written on there. But essentially, they were the same cards, different card stock, slightly different look. Leaf would do the same thing. They produced a bilingual French and English set of baseball cards to be released in Canada starting, 1985, I believe. And much like OPG baseball versus Topps baseball was very much like finding the Canadian quarter in the coin slot of your Coke machine when you got your change back. You're like, oh, it's a quarter, but not really. It's kind of like 20 cents. Same thing here. You know, if you've ever opened up a lot of cards and mixed in with those Topps cards or the OPG cards, you're going, oh, they're kind of like Topps cards, but not really. That's what you would get with Leaf cards. Yeah, they looked like Donruss cards, But yeah, you know, the exchange rate says, okay, it's only about 68 cents to the dollar. You know, you're just like, oh, Debbie Downer. And Leaf decided to shake things up by taking what was just kind of the, you know, trade-off Canadian version of the Donruss base set. And they decided to use that brand for some premium sets, actually starting in 1990. And we've talked about the 1990 Leaf set before. Nothing great, but a pretty nice first step forward into the premium sets that became all the rage in the early 90s. You could see the set improved in 1991 as well as 92, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But Leaf also did something rather clever, not just repurposing the Canadian brand and launching a new product line off that, but then started to do some interesting little side projects with it. And Leaf Studio was definitely one of the most interesting side projects, as it took the average baseball card and turned it into a little bit of a work of art, but also great access into the personal lives of the baseball players. And that's something that baseball cards often aren't able to do, and that is add some personality to the player. Normally, baseball cards, sure, you had a picture of the player, and you had a whole lot of stats on the player, but that was about it. Occasionally, you would have a Topps cartoon that might throw in a fun little interesting tidbit about the player, or maybe some trivial piece was on the back of a card. You know, his favorite sport when not playing baseball is, you know, surfing or something like that. And you could get some interesting personality bits and pieces out of that. But Studio took it a little further. Now, let's first start actually with the back of the card as I talk about the interesting tidbits. Now, the design of the back of the card is actually incessantly boring. It is really lacking. I think they were trying to go for classy, sharp. I don't want to say nostalgic. They were going for a film noir look, but it just looks like 1991 clip art, and it probably was, really. So despite the aesthetic boringness to the back of the Studio cards, once you get reading into it, you got some pretty interesting points here. Now, you had the usual personal stuff, you know, where they were born, birth date, stuff like that. And some interesting career stats, too. And these weren't just numbers. This was all written out dialogue. Not all that different from what Donruss was doing on the backs of their cards in 1981. But then you got to the two most interesting lines. Hobbies and interest and hero. And I actually, on the video of the two packs that we opened, I spent a lot of time flipping the cards over and reading about the hobbies and interest and the player's heroes. And keeping in mind that this is 1991, most of the hobbies and interest were popular TV shows of the time. So The Simpsons, Married with Children, In Living Color. Boy, that was a great show. And heroes were interesting because a lot of players would mention their dad or, you know, a big name baseball star. And then others, you would have some very interesting choices. Like one of the cards that we pulled, it was a big race car fan and his hero was AJ Foyt. So in terms of getting to know the players better, the backs of the Studio cards actually did that very well. Now the front of the cards did too, as this was a great effort by Leaf to not only give the players some personality, but in a studio setting, kind of get them at some off-guard moments. And what I mean by that is not really staging anything, but having a player sit down in front of a photo backdrop. And you've seen these sessions before where the players may be having a conversation with somebody and laughing and joking around, and the photographer just takes 20 pictures in quick succession all at once. And you get the player experiencing a real emotion in a real moment of time. So you also get a chance to kind of break down the bravado a little bit and also the rather standard pictures of players in action on the ball field. And you get kind of this relaxed, somewhat personalized look, sometimes funny look at players. And it's a rather unique approach to bringing ball players and professional athletes closer to the fans. And it was interesting that this was being done at this time, because I think you could sense that the fan and player relationship, which was already vastly different in the early 90s compared to, say, the 1950s, was starting to enter a new phase as more and more players became millionaire-a-year players. And whether it was because of social status or security, there was much more space being put between players and fans. And the only people who could get access to these players were naturally the rich people, the people who could buy those lower box seats, the people who could buy pregame batting practice access onto the field or even into the stadium. So while that new gap between players and fans was starting to form, this was a unique way of kind of bridging that gap a little bit to where fans could get to know the players without actually necessarily being in the same space with them. So you've got some pretty neat artistic shots of players. Some of them just look like your standard Olin Mills high school photos. Others, though, look pretty sharp in the black and white film stock, with kind of this magenta small border around the side and a gold Studio 91 logo up in the corner. So these sets make for some nice photography. I'm not necessarily sure if they're great for autographs because of the UV coating that was being used back in the day. Sometimes the Sharpie ink would eventually fade and bubble out. But it is definitely an interesting way of looking at players, and especially if you were a kid, getting to know a little more about the players and kind of seeing them in a more relaxed pose. Now, if you are looking for the studio cards, it's pretty easy to get them. As I was shopping around on eBay, you can buy a box of Leaf Studio with shipping. It was somewhere around the $20 mark. Now, for those without shipping, they were a little closer to $15, and of course, shipping depended on, the service and where you are. It could be an additional $10 or $15 for that. But generally speaking, the studio cards are pretty affordable, and they're very easy to put together a set because there's only 264 cards in the set. Now, coming back to the 90s nostalgia warning, should we get excited about some of these cards? Not really. Even the Jeff Bagwell rookie card, which is arguably the biggest card in the set, it's only valued at a couple of dollars. And Craig Biggio, who is next to Bagwell in the set, appropriately, of course, they were organizing these cards in alphabetical order, not just by player name, but by team name, with which team they were with, he said confidently. But the Biggio card's only valued at, I think, 50 cents right now. So even some of the big star players at the time, including Edgar Martinez or Roberto Alomar, Tom Glavin, Nolan Ryan, sure, some of those names might get you a buck or two, but generally speaking, the others won't. And again, it's a supply and demand kind of thing here. But if you're looking for an affordable option that won't set you back, that won't take an eternity to put together, and is a really neat collection of photography and player facts and a different look and feel to baseball cards than what was generally being produced in 1991, then I highly recommend taking a peek at 91 Leaf Studio. Now, as I mentioned before, the Leaf brand was launched in 1990 as a premium set and gradually got better by 1992. And by 92, you had a set that not only featured some pretty good action photography, great card stock, crisp, clear photography, a sharp, simple look, action photos on the back, counterfeit proof measures baked into the backs of the cards too, but also the black gold cards. Yes, not quite liquid gold of Velveeta macaroni and cheese, but the black gold, boy, that was the thing back then, wasn't it? Boy, if you could just put gold anything on there, you could put gold dog poop in a pack of baseball cards then, and it was seen as premium. Gold was the rage, and what looks good with gold? Black. They're good complementary colors. Ask the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Ask the Pittsburgh Penguins, who were originally wearing blue and white, and then they realized the other teams were wearing black and gold and winning championships, so yeah, we should change to that too. It's a good look. And the card companies figured that out pretty quickly. Topps was putting out black gold cards by 1992. Well, Donruss, or should I say Leaf, was definitely not going to be left in the dust. So for the 528 cards, and that was split up over two 264 card series, you had a black gold parallel, and you had a black gold card in each pack. So you got your black gold, you got a pretty sharp premium set, and you also had the very interesting Gold Leaf Rookie subset. Now, this was nothing new. You saw it in previous sets. And thanks to the massive popularity of a Jeff Bagwell 1991 Gold Leaf Rookie, everybody thought that every Gold Leaf Rookie card was going to be a hit. Well, in 1992, that is not the case. The only one that really stands out is Pedro Martinez. Now, you do have other players who had decent careers in there. Raul Mondesi, Todd Hundley, Kenny Lofton. Let's see, who else here? Brett Boone. But really, the general consensus of the rookie cards was not a windfall of big names. Now, if you are somebody who collects cards of interesting names, you can get Patrick Mahomes Sr. Yes, Dad of the Kansas City Chiefs quarterback is card number 17 of that particular set. But like the Leaf Studio set, you're not going to get a ton of value out of these cards, but it is still a fun set and an easy set at 528 cards spread out over two series. That's not all that hard. And for the price, it's a good rainy day activity. And again, just checking out eBay, finding, you know, a box of Series 1 or Series 2, typically going for, you know, around $12 to $15. Some dealers looking to unload those will get you a box of each with shipping for $30, which is not a bad deal for two boxes of baseball cards. So that's just another suggestion if you're looking for what was considered a premium card but does not come at a premium price these days. Definitely may want to check out not just 92 Leaf, but also the 90 and 91 sets as well, because they do stack up and hold up well. But 92, again, because they don't have the Bagwell rookie card in there, the Gold Leaf rookie card, and because the checklist is good but not great, 92 Leaf is a pretty viable option for affordability, easy to collect, and a pretty sharp set to look at. So again, if you're getting caught up in your 90s nostalgia, but you don't want to overpay for a ridiculous box of 89 Fleer or something similar to that, then I do recommend either 92 Leaf or 91 Studio. And the Studio brand would also, you know, continue for a few years afterwards and get a little more artistic, get a little more creative. So I definitely suggest checking those out too, or at least kind of revisiting them if you haven't. Now, speaking of revisiting, let's revisit some fun names from that time. And I'm not talking just goofy names here. No, I'm talking about big name players, some of them successful, others not so much. And let's actually start with the two cards that I pulled from the Studio packs, including Phil Plantier. Remember Phil Plantier? He was one of those big prospects who is supposed to be one of the next big things, in this case for the Boston Red Sox. Now, Phil Plantier was born just outside of Boston, Manchester, New Hampshire, January 1969, an 11th round draft pick of the Red Sox in 1987. And because he was such a prolific home run hitter in the minor leagues, he skipped Double A, which is a very curious move by the Boston Red Sox, because anybody who follows minor league baseball knows that Double A is typically the make or break point in a prospect's development. If you are struggling at Double A, or perhaps you're getting into your mid-20s by the time you're in Double A, there are plenty of doubts of not only can you make it to the majors, but are you worthy of a roster spot with a Triple A team? So the choice by the Red Sox to move the youngster Plantier, the infielder, past Double A is rather stunning, actually. But in the day and age where the ball was starting to fly out of the park a little bit, plus perhaps game planning for life after Wade Boggs, the Red Sox decided to rush him up rather quickly through the organization. Makes his major league debut as a midseason call-up from nearby Pawtucket in 1990, part of that 1990 American League East Division winning team. And he had a nice little cup of coffee, but nothing really to write home about. It was a decent pinch hitter, but that was pretty much it. Now, in the middle of the 1991 season, comes back up, gets another cup of coffee, goes back down to Pawtucket, finally makes his return in August of 1991, and takes the Red Sox by storm. Now, the Red Sox at this point in time, distant contenders. You had Toronto and Detroit, Milwaukee all fighting for the American League East flag that year. It wasn't happening in Boston. So he got plenty of playing time. And in 53 games, has 11 home runs, 35 RBI, and hit .331. An interesting stat here, he hit a home run for every 13.38 at-bats. So you think about that. You get four at-bats a game. Once every three games, essentially, he's knocking it out of the park. And it gives Red Sox fans some hope and, again, some flexibility for the organization. Hey, maybe we can move Boggs to DH. Maybe this is our guy who's going to be here for much of the near future. Well, unfortunately for Plantier, that wouldn't happen. In fact, in 1992, he fell well short of expectations, and after that season was traded to the San Diego Padres, where he was able to rejuvenate his career, actually hit 34 home runs with 100 RBI for the 93 Padres. That's saying a lot, too, considering the National League then was not really known as a home run launching league, but also the old Jack Murphy Stadium, which sadly I saw is going to get knocked down soon. But the old Jack Murphy Stadium was not known as a home run hitting park. So the Padres got a pretty good steal here, exchanging Jose Melendez to the Red Sox for Plantier. So Plantier would have a very productive 1993 season, fell off in an injury-plagued and shortened 1994 season, and heading into 1995, he's traded by the Padres along with Derek Bell, Doug Brocale, Ricky Gutierrez, and Pedro Martinez, the lefty, not the one you're thinking of, and Craig Shipley to Houston in the big trade that netted Ken Caminiti to the Padres, as well as Andujar Cedeño, Steve Finley, Roberto Pettijean, Brian Williams, and Sean Fesch. Now, the time in Houston was also very short, as the Astros, midway through the season, trade Plantier back to San Diego for Rich Loisel and Jeff Tabaka. So this would be tour number two with San Diego. He wouldn't be done with the Padres, though. After a rather milquetoast 1995 season, Plantier was on the move once again, as he was released by the Padres and signs as a free agent with Detroit. Right before the 1996 season, traded to Oakland for Fausto Cruz and Ramon Fermin, has a rather, I don't want to say forgettable, but a season that doesn't really excite a lot of people in Oakland. Hits only 212 in 73 games in 1996, but finds his way back to San Diego via free agency. Signs as a free agent January 1997, tour number 3 with the Padres. That too, short-lived, as midway through the 1997 season, traded along with Scott Livingstone and Fernando Valenzuela to St. Louis for Rich Batchelor, Danny Jackson, and Mark Sweeney. After the 97 season, granted free agency, tried to latch on with the Toronto Blue Jays in 1998, but never did play a game with them after spring training. Now, Plantier would catch on in coaching shortly after his playing career. Named manager of the Macon Music, that's a cool name, of the South Coast League, the short-lived South Coast League in Macon, Georgia, back in 2007. Was then a coach and manager throughout the Mariners organization, later a minor league hitting coordinator for the Mariners, and then comes back to San Diego as a player, as a hitting coach for 3 seasons, and is still bouncing around in the minor leagues, most recently with the Yankees organization with Scranton Wilkes-Barre as a hitting coach. He was also a coach for the United States national baseball team in a 2019 tournament team, just missing an opportunity to qualify for the 2020 Olympics through that tournament. Now, an interesting side note about Plantier. I read a book a couple of years ago called Class A, written by Lucas Mann, and it's centered around, I think it was the 2010 season of the Clinton Lumber Kings. And what should have been a very interesting look at the Clinton Lumber Kings, a low A minor league club for the Seattle Mariners, and, you know, how the players are trying to become stars, how some coaches are trying to hang on, and how minor league baseball can be so influential in a dying Rust Belt town such as Clinton, Iowa. Unfortunately, the author, gets, you know, just way too deep. And it just, it's one of those books that just slogs on and on and on. And honestly, a book about baseball should not slog ever. It should be a fun read. And that was not the case. But he mentioned being in a bar with Phil Plantier when he was in town. I guess Plantier was just getting drunk and talking about the good old days of his playing days. But I thought I'd mention that for absolutely no good reason. All right, now another interesting player who kind of falls in the Phil Plantier category, and we'll actually see a couple of common trends here with some of the other cards that we're talking about, is Kevin Moss. Yes, Kevin Moss. Remember Kevin Moss? Boy, if you pulled a Leaf Studio 91 Kevin Moss card back in 1991, that was worth several dollars. But you had to sell quickly because the aura of Kevin Moss very quickly disappeared. But he's doing just fine for himself nowadays. Born in Castro Valley, California, drafted by the Yankees in the 22nd round of the 1986 draft, following his days at the University of California, he would make his major league debut in June of 1990 and gets his first major league hit off Jack McDowell, who was at the top of his game. But Moss had the book on McDowell. He used to face him when he was playing against him in college numerous times. To say that Kevin Moss got off to a hot start would be an incredibly, incredibly major understatement. He set a record for the fewest at-bats for a rookie to hit 10 home runs. That was just 72 at-bats. And he also set a record for the fastest rookie to 13 and 15 home runs with 110 and 133 at-bats, respectively. And he also had a memorable 3-game series at Texas where he homered in each game of the series. So remember, he was called up June 29th, 1990, and this, you know, terrible rebuilding Yankees team, much like a not terrible but still kind of on the up team in Boston helping out Phil Plantier, certainly helped out Kevin Moss at the time. By the end of the season, just 79 games played, he had 21 home runs and actually finished in second place for the Sporting News Rookie of the Year Award behind Sandy Alomar Jr. Now, much like Plantier was being seen as the heir apparent to third base for Wade Boggs and the Red Sox, of course, the Yankees looking at utilizing Moss as the eventual replacement for Don Mattingly. And Mattingly was actually a little bit of a mentor for Moss, and Moss loved being around some of the legendary Yankees players, many of them, of course, coming back for Legends Day at Yankee Stadium at some point in time. So overall, his experience in New York was incredible. He had a little fan club, a lot of young ladies called Moss Tops. They would wear a shirt on top of their shirt. So anytime that Moss homered, typically into the right field stands, like most left-handed hitters, the Moss Top ladies would get up, take off that top shirt, and, you know, kind of twirl it around in the air. I mean, this is pretty crazy stuff for the Yankees in the early 90s. Now, like Phil Plantier kind of fell off a plateau, that was definitely the case for Kevin Moss. Played a full season in 1992, just hit .220, though, 128 strikeouts in that season. And by 1992, he's going, you know, back and forth into the minor leagues, and was released by the Yankees in 1994. Tried a few times to get back into the major leagues. Had a very brief time with the Minnesota Twins in 1995, and actually played in Japan in 1996. With the Hanshin Tigers, he replaced another first baseman who had lost a little bit of his mojo, Glenn Davis. Now, after his playing career, he decided to mix things up, take a dare, and utilize his degree from Cal into personal financing. And after doing some work in the insurance industry, got into personal financing with Charles Schwab. He is still based in his hometown of Castro Valley, California, and is occasionally a participant at Old Timers Day at Yankee Stadium. So you may laugh at those Kevin Moss cards that you collected that are worth maybe about 6 cents, but you may want to give Kevin Moss a call to see how you can utilize that junk wax collection of cards to get a little better return on investment. Now on to the 92 Leaf packs that we had. Another player that you could string along here in the Phil Plantier and Kevin Moss club, Greg Jeffries. Now, while Kevin Moss had it a little tough after a very successful rookie season, Greg Jeffries was put through the meat grinder in New York. And pretty much all parties say, being a young player with the Mets when Jeffries came up in 1987 was just a very, very bad place to be. The Yankees, you still had the Yankee way. Even though the Yankees were not a very good team at the time, you still had the Yankee way. You had the Yankee legends. You could share a dugout on Legends Day with Whitey Ford and Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio. How cool is that? In the same time, in the Mets, you were sharing the dugout with cocaine and other sorts of, shall we say, distractions, plus a rather toxic clubhouse. And there's been a bit of a reckoning for Greg Jeffries over the last year or so. We'll get into that in just a little bit. But first, let's talk about how he got to this point. Greg Jeffries, born in Burlingame, California, 1967. He was heavily trained by his father, Rich, very supportive mother, Joan, as well. His dad was the baseball coach at Parksdale High School in San Bruno, California. And he would push his son, Greg, through this incredibly insane workout regimen, which Sports Illustrated did a feature article on back, I want to say in 1986 or 87, where Greg worked out 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, had all sorts of bizarre workout programs, including swinging a bat underwater in the swimming pool. And it was somewhat ahead of its time, but also somewhat very lunatic fringe of training at that time. Now, he not only played baseball in high school, he also played football And he was originally going to play both college baseball and football at Cal State Fullerton. However, here come the Mets. They sign him in the first round of the 1985 amateur draft, 20th overall. And all that hard work and training seems to pay off very early on for Greg Jeffries. Starting, hang on, for Greg Jeffries, as he was very quickly moved up the Mets ladder, was one of the first stars pegged by Baseball America. He was named Baseball America's Minor League Player of the Year in 1986 and 1987. He hit 367 with 20 home runs, 48 doubles, 100 RBI for the Jackson Mets in 1987. Has a cup of coffee at the end of the 87 season and has a rather impressive little stint there. He goes 3-for-6 in 6 games. He was also at that time the youngest player in the major leagues at 19. Now, the Mets decide, okay, he's ready to go. But where do we put him? Now, Jeffries was primarily a second baseman, could also play third base as well, and shortstop too. They couldn't put him in the outfield because you already had a pretty dedicated outfield. And there was no room in the infield because you had Wally Backman, you had Howard Johnson, you had Kevin Elster, you had Keith Hernandez. You had guys already pretty much set in the infield. So with nowhere to go, he starts in AAA in 1988. Has a pretty decent start. Gets called up and ends up hitting 321 over the final 29 games of the 1988 season. Now, this is the last hurrah for the Mets, who go into the NLCS and have their hearts broken by what seems to be a destined Dodger team going on to the World Series that year. And after the 88 season, the Mets are like, okay, we're ready. We've got our guy. So they trade Wally Backman, who was very popular in the locker room, to make room for Jeffries. And that does not sit well with the core of the Mets locker room. Now, keep in mind, this is a Mets team that had primarily, for the most part, come up together through the organization, through the rebuild of the early 80s. The Mets team that had partied hard together. The Mets team that had won that World Series in 1986 together. And even though they weren't quite performing to levels of competence that they were in past years, they were still a tight, if not toxic, bunch. So when you try to introduce a 20-year-old to a locker room that's got hardcore, hard-partying veteran players, such as Daryl Strawberry and Dwight Gooden and Keith Hernandez. And all right, Gary Carter wasn't as hard of a partier, but he was a core piece of that. Like I said, Howard Johnson and Lenny Dykstra, Mookie Wilson, all these other players who'd been there for a while. It's hard for the rookie to break in. And this is part of the reckoning that's going on right now. Had the Greg Jeffries stories happened today, it would be 180 degrees different. He would be a prized prospect. He would be very quickly moved into the organization, very quickly moved up the ladder. And if any veteran players didn't like the new rookie, it was the veteran player who was run out of town. Not in the late 1980s. It was the rookie who had a very hard time breaking into that circle. Now, what made it even tougher for Jeffries was that strange background that followed him. Not only a mom and dad that were lording over him and following him around in a trailer from one minor league city to another, but he also had some eccentricities to him. He liked his own bats. He had very special custom-made bats. And he would wipe down his bats with alcohol wipes after the game. He would not want his bats with the rest of the bats of the back rack. They had to be stored in a different type of bag. They needed to be carried around differently. He just had this infatuation, almost this OCD complex with his bats. The Mets didn't really like it. So eventually, things start getting ugly in New York very quickly with Jeffries and the Mets. The players think that he's an oddball, that he's a spoiled brat, that he's this golden child, and he's going to take our jobs. And by moving Wally Backman, that caused a rift. The Mets also acquired Juan Samuel in a trade, but they couldn't put him at second because, well, that's where Jeffries was. So they stuck Samuel in the outfield, which was not a natural position for him, or certainly not a strength of his. Well, the Mets weren't going to move Howard Johnson. They weren't going to completely reshuffle everything. So you already have this very difficult fish out of water situation for Jeffries, and it's getting even more and more difficult because the Mets are mismanaging how they're using him. The expectations are of a golden child status. That doesn't work well with the veterans. You have the eccentricities of him too, and things start falling apart rather quickly, starting in 1989, when former Met teammate Roger McDowell, who was then with the Phillies, at the end of the 1989 season, Jeffries was the last batter to ground out before the Mets lost the game. And Jeffries was jawing at McDowell on his way to first base and basically incites a bench-clearing brawl between the two teams. And that was actually a bit of a sequel, because what started this off was in a previous game where it was McDowell versus Jeffries. Jeffries swings at a McDowell pitch. The pitch breaks Jeffries' bat. And McDowell, as he's fielding the ball and Jeffries is running down first base, you know, McDowell basically yells at him, "Well, how do you like your bat now?" The bats were also the center of contention and dissension in the Met locker room. When several players, I believe it was Daryl Strawberry actually, took all of Jeffries' bats and just emptied them out in the middle of the locker room. Another player also took a game bat from Jeffries and sawed it in half. Another player, in fact, it might have been McDowell, when Jeffries was struggling as a hitter and Davey Johnson still dutifully wrote him into the lineup every time, wrote on the lineup card, and this is McDowell, wrote on the card, "Are we still trying?" So by year number three with the Mets, things are just spiraling out of control for Greg Jeffries. He just cannot handle what is going on. Well, Jeffries is also dealing with the New York media and a very testy New York fan base as the Mets team is starting to get peeled apart by trades and veterans moving on in free agency. Jeffries is clearly not living up to the expectations, which were already way too lofty to begin with. So in May of 1991, Jeffries had an open letter read on WFAN that basically spilled out everything that was going wrong. And he was basically just calling out his teammates, calling out the organization, just basically said that, you know, that he just couldn't take it anymore. In fact, one line from the letter says, and I quote, "If only we can concentrate more on the games than complaining and bickering and pointing fingers, we would all be better off." So allegedly that letter was written to tell the whole story, but it just completely blew everything up. And by the end of the 1991 season, Jeffries is no longer playing with the Mets. And we'll get into, you know, his exit there in just a moment. But as it would later be revealed in an interview with STL Today, a St. Louis publication, Jeffries said he never wrote the letter. He won't say who did write the letter, but he does imply that somebody who was giving him advice, and he says it wasn't his parents, but somebody who was giving him advice, gave him the bad advice to kind of air it out and do so on the radio airwaves. So Jeffries didn't write it. Maybe it was some thoughts that were in his head that had been spoken to this person, but he denies ever writing or delivering that letter. Still, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And at the end of the 1991 season, even though he hit .272, with the team sliding into the basement in the National League East, they send him along with Kevin McReynolds and Keith Miller to the Kansas City Royals for Bill Pecota and Brett Saberhagen. Of course, Saberhagen would become a bit of a problem child with the Mets during his tenure there. Now, in 1992, as you see pictured in the 1992 Leaf card here, a nice spring training picture of him with the Kansas City Royals, he would become a free agent, signs with the St. Louis Cardinals, and would actually revive his career. Had a couple of quality seasons in 1993 and 94. In fact, was part of the National League All-Star team in both seasons. Would become a free agent in 1994 with the Philadelphia Phillies. And he did fairly well over the next few years, however, started to deal with some injuries that limited his playing time and certainly his effectiveness. He would later move on to the Anaheim Angels, also the Detroit Tigers, and at the end of the 2001 season, ended his career. Finishes his career with a .289 batting average, 126 home runs, and 663 RBI. And right now, he is living in Las Vegas at last check and is operating the Office Sports Academy and is also a freelance hitting instructor. His son, Jake, a 2015 draft pick of the Washington Nationals. Now, as I said, he is experiencing, Greg Jeffries, a bit of a reckoning these days. I mentioned the STL Today article. There was also a nice article in the New York Post, believe it or not. Never thought I'd string those words together. Nice article in the New York Post recently, taking a second look at Jeffries and all those eccentricities and what he could do as a player, his skill level. And there is pretty much the consensus that had Jeffries been playing now as opposed to 30 years ago, it would have been a completely different story. In fact, he was one of the top ranked, top scouted players. People thought he was a surefire Hall of Famer when he was making his major league debut in the 1980s. So it was unfortunate for him. In fact, Baseball America, again, you know, the first publication to really get Jeffries out there publicly in 2017, called him their most highly regarded prospect until Andrew Jones. So they still hold him rather highly. It's just wrong place, wrong time. And Jeffries will admit to wrong reactions in some situations. However, something that has helped Jeffries is a lot of his former teammates, including Hernandez and Ron Darling and David Cohn and Daryl Strawberry, have all since, done a little bit of peace talking with him since then. And they now realize that he was put in a bad situation. He didn't necessarily respond to the situation real well, but he was just in the wrong place. There was just no good reason to have a 19-year-old with that grizzled, party-hard, you know, Mets crowd in 1989, 1990. So rather unfortunate for him, but he's at peace with his career. Actually, I shouldn't say with his career. He's at peace with his life, but all indications are, as it comes to his career, he feels he really left a lot undone. And I'm sure that's something that's got to drive him crazy all these years later. But again, just wrong situation for him, and that's unfortunate. Sometimes that happens. Now, our last player, which was also in the 1992 Leaf pack, a player whose name I recognized instantly because he's one of those players that often doesn't get the credit due for a team's particular successful season. And you would be hard-pressed to say that there is no player on the 1991 Minnesota Twins roster who often gets overlooked than Kevin Tappany. And you think of, obviously, Scott Erickson had that great year. You had Jack Morris, the wily veteran, that Game 7 performance in the World Series. And then you think of the position players. You had Kirby Puckett, Ken Herbeck, Gary Gaetti, Dan Gladden, Brian Harper, you know, all those guys that played key roles in that surprising Twins World Series run against the equally surprising Atlanta Braves in 1991. Well, Kevin Tappany, an interesting story here. He was born in Des Moines, Iowa, but he spent most of his life in the UP, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Why was he born in Des Moines? Well, his father, Ray, was a goaltender for the United States Hockey League's Des Moines Oak Leafs in the 1963-64 season. And his father played some semi-pro minor league hockey. And finally, after just, you know, not being able to make it as a professional hockey player, he returns to the Upper Peninsula and starts working as a computer programmer. So that is where Kevin grew up. And of course, baseball, not exactly made for the seasons in the UP. So while Kevin Tappany enjoyed playing baseball, he actually excelled in football. He was a quarterback at his high school. Helped his team get to the Class A State Football Championship in 1981. Signs on with Central Michigan University. Yep, he becomes a Chip. Was supposed to be playing football. However, during a Dodgers tryout nearby, he was scouted not only by the Dodgers, but also the Central Michigan coaching staff and said, and they saw him, they said, how would you like to play for the team? He's like, okay, yeah, you know, I can try out. And they said, well, the season started 2 weeks ago. How would you like to play for the team? So in the most unique of situations here, Kevin Tappany becomes a walk-on and an absolute stud for the Chips from 1983 to 1986, threw a no-hitter against Eastern Michigan University in 1986, also had a complete career record of 23-8, helping the team get to 3 Mid-American Conference titles. Now, he was originally drafted by the Chicago Cubs in 1985, opted not to sign, wanted to complete his education, and in 1986, drafted by the Oakland A's, even though he couldn't get a really good contract with them, decides to sign with the A's, starts moving up through their minor league system, and then is part of a big 3-team trade in December of 1987. He and Wally Whitehurst went to the Mets. Bob Welch, Matt Young go to the Dodgers. Jack Savage, goes from the Dodgers to the Mets. Alfredo Griffin, Jay Howell, Jesse Orosco, all part of this deal as well. So now he is in the Mets farm system. A lot of people probably forget that Tappany actually started with the Mets. He would make his major league debut in July of 1989, July 4th to be exact, thanks to Bob Ojeda getting torched in a game against Houston. But Tappany was able to hold his own in relief, and he starts getting the attention of the Mets organization. Now, the Mets, still trying to get the last drops of juice out of a veteran team, decided to make a big trade, picking up, you know, some veteran players in exchange for some youngsters. So the Mets trade Tappany to the Minnesota Twins for Frank Viola. And it seems like it's pretty good deal here. Viola was going to get a new contract at the end of the season. The Twins weren't going to pay it. So you have Viola, Rick Aguilera, Tim Drummond, Jack Savage, and David West all involved in that trade. So in his brief time with the Twins in 1989, again, has a pretty decent run there. Also had a pretty good 1990 season as well, becomes a fixture of the starting rotation, and then comes 1991. Even though he didn't really stand out in the playoffs, in fact, had a couple rough starts against both Toronto and Atlanta in the 1991 playoffs, he was a workhorse in the starting rotation. 16-9 record, 244 innings pitched, a 2.99 earned run average, 135 strikeouts to only 40 walks. Arguably the best season of his career. And actually, he was in the Cy Young Award voting, a candidate in 1991. Of course, a distant seventh, let's be honest there. Roger Clemens running away with the trophy there. But certainly was of star quality in 1991. Now, the Twins after 1991 were not of star quality. The team rapidly declined and started getting pulled apart, much like the Twins moving Frank Viola to not give him a big contract in his free agent year. Same thing happens with Tappany in 1995, traded to the LA Dodgers for Ron Coomer, Chris Latham, Jose Parra, and Greg Hansel. Safe to say, the Dodgers won that trade there. Unfortunately for Tappany, would continue to have some struggles in the postseason, got shelled in Game 3 of the Division Series against the Cincinnati Reds. Reds would sweep that series. Becomes a free agent in 1995, the winter of 1995, I should say, going into the 1996 season, has a rather average year with the Chicago White Sox after a one-year deal there. Following 1996, signs a five-year deal with the Chicago Cubs, and arguably his biggest moment as a member of the Cubs comes at the plate, actually. July 20th, 1998, hits a grand slam off of his former Twins teammate, Danny Nagel, in an 11-4 win over the Atlanta Braves. Tappany would finish his career in 2001. Not spectacular numbers-wise, 143 wins to 125 losses, ERA of 4.35, and more wins than losses, more solid showings than not. But a guy who, again, had one solid season and was part of one memorable team with the Twins in 1991. Returned to his hometown of Minnetonka, Minnesota, with his wife and kids. One of his children, which one was it? Ryan, I believe, was drafted in the major leagues a couple years ago. And right now, Kevin Tappany is currently a high school baseball coach at Providence Academy in Plymouth, Minnesota. So even the players that do have decent major league careers, and certainly Tappany's career was a little more fruitful than Moss or Jeffries or Plantier's, sometimes it comes down to just one magical, memorable season. And that's certainly what Tappany had in 1991. And like I said, a very overlooked player. But if you look at what he did and how he was able to help with the workload that he was able to carry, help keep the bullpen nice and fresh and healthy throughout the 1991 season, that certainly helped the Twins, who got off to a really rough start in 91, help them out, ultimately winning the World Series in that epic seven-game battle with the Atlanta Braves. Well, that'll do it with our look at 1991 Leaf Studio and 1992 Leaf sets. Again, premium sets that don't come at a premium price anymore, thanks to the fact that they are part of the junk wax era. But that, again, is a victory for you if you're somebody who just wants to have a little fun couple of hours opening up packs and trying to put together sets. That Leaf Studio set, only 264 cards. Box is available for about $15, $20, depending on where you shop. And the Leaf set from 1992, two series of 264 cards each for 528 total cards, plus the black gold parallels also. You can find those boxes around $15 a pop, too. So if you're looking to have that 90s nostalgia, when you want to go back to the days where it seems so much simpler, yet the internet was so much slower, I don't know why we think it's so much simpler to go back to the, you know, mid-1990s. But hey, all right, you want to go back to the 90s, but you don't want to sink in a ton of money on some of these cards that are starting to get some interest once again. Definitely look at these two sets. They kind of fall in the same category as some of the Fleer Ultra sets from the early 1990s. You know, some very good premium sets that came out. But we're a little overproduced. That still means you can get some good value for what you go out and buy nowadays. Now, we're not going to have any good value. We're going to have some true turkeys coming your way in our next program. That's right. I did warn you. Friday, November 20th, we'll take a look at some turkey cards. No, not turkey red. 90 Donruss, 89 Bowman. Yeah, we'll be bringing all that for you. Just have a little fun with that show. And also upcoming 63 Fleer. We'll do that. That'll be our first show in the month of December. Don't forget cardboard donations. Matt Salmon says with a Z at gmail.com or cash donations, paypal.me/WaxExstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us here for another episode of Wax Ecstatic, and we will see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.